Advantage Medical, providing supplies and equipment to the rehabilitation industry since 1994. For fast, courteous, efficient service, dial 800-577-5694 or our website, AdvantageMedical.com.
This is PT Talker, presented by Advantage Medical. The aim of this podcast is to expose physical therapists to unique and innovative ideas to help grow their business. Each broadcast will introduce you to new concepts that will save you time, provide a better patient outcome, or lower your cost. And now, the host of PT Talker, Jeff Worrell.
Good morning, good afternoon, or maybe it's good evening, depending where in the world you're listening to this edition of PT Talker. I want to welcome you all back. And of course, I said yes, where in the world? We have listeners now in Australia. And of course, we want to welcome back all of our listeners from Germany that we had the other day. And we have some from England. So welcome to all of our international listeners, as well as our regular United States and Canadian listeners that are tuning in each and every week. This is Jeff Worrell, and I'm happy to be here because we're going to take on a topic today that I have found to be very interesting. A lot of questions, your emails that you're sending me about stroke and how to manage stroke patients, how to deal with them. And we had the great fortune of contacting Mr. Peter Levine, who is with the University of Cincinnati. Peter, welcome to our show today.
Thanks, Jeff.
You know, before we get started, I've got to give a big shout-out to Susan. Susan, thank you for your very kind email about our topic 2 weeks ago. I'm a little behind and recognize you, so I want to give you a shout-out. I know you're practicing hard at the hospital there in New Jersey and dealing with all those orthopedic patients, and I appreciate your kind comments. Well, with us today, Peter Levine, as I said, and you have written a book, Stronger After Stroke. And first of all, I want to welcome you and ask you, how does it feel to be an author? You're a researcher, but you took some of your knowledge and you put it into a book that's actually very easy for people to use, I understand.
Yeah, well, how does it feel to be an author? Tough question. Basically, you know, you get addicted to looking at your Amazon rankings.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things I want to talk about with you today is neuroplastic change in the brain of stroke survivors after stroke. And I swear my brain has been rewired by the amount of times that I go and check my Amazon ranking. There's all kinds of websites you can go. You can compete against other books. It's great fun, but it's a bit addictive. And now I'm on to writing my second book, and so now my energies are taken away from this book and put towards the other one, but that's the life of an author.
Good for you. I'll have to find out if there's such a thing for podcasts. We'll have to see if such a thing exists. But now you were going to, I know for the benefit of our listeners, you and I, before we went on the air, we're talking about neuroplastic change, and you talked about rewiring the brain. Tell me what you mean by that exactly.
Well, it happens in all of us all the time, whether we like it or not. It happens with good habits. It happens with bad habits. We have 100 billion neurons in our brains. We have a quadrillion synapses. That number of synapses can increase or decrease. There's pruning. There's all kinds of things that go on. And as we learn something, the connection between neurons that do that something are strengthened. And if we don't do something, those neuronal connections are either weeded, or the synapses are weeded, or the neurons go towards some other skill. So, you know, it doesn't matter if you're learning French or learning how to play basketball. It's all the same process. And one of the things I try to emphasize to therapists is that if you look at neuroplastic change in your own life and then try to superimpose it on patients, it's probably better than trying to abstract what's going on in the heads of, you know, stroke survivors or other people with acquired brain injury.
Mm-hmm. So if we have a listener out there, one of our physical therapists that is dealing with stroke patients on a regular basis, what is something that they might find in your book that they maybe didn't pick up in school or just were not aware of? Maybe intuitively they're aware of it because they're dealing with this every day, but it just hadn't registered yet.
Well, there's been a big shift. When I first got involved in rehabilitation research for stroke, it was at the Kessler Institute, which is a big rehab hospital on the East Coast in New Jersey in the United States. And there was a bunch of really smart people, MDs, PhDs, running around trying to figure out what helps stroke survivors get better. The one thing that I didn't realize when I first got started was that they kind of knew that a lot of the things that therapists had been using were not particularly effective, and this became clear in a series of meta-analysis and other articles, research articles that came out that said when they took some of the neurofacilitation techniques and put it up against standard therapy, there was really no difference. And so we had all this data capture stuff. We could do kinematics, we could do kinetics, we could do EMG, we could do all three at the same time. And then we had MRI, fMRI, we had transcranial magnetic stimulation. Now we could see if there was neuroplastic change in the brain. The problem was nobody knew what drove it. Mm-hmm. And right around that time, I got involved with a researcher who's still my boss, Dr. Stephen Page, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Page, J. Page, very well known for several things, but one of them is modifying constraint-induced therapy. This is where you constrain the unaffected side and force use of the affected side. And that and the work of Edward Taub, the guy who developed constraint-induced therapy, opened this deluge, because all of a sudden we started to see really robust neuroplastic rewiring in stroke survivors, sometimes years after their stroke. So if there's one thing I would tell therapists is if you focus on the sort of cardinal rules of driving neuroplastic change, repetitive, task-specific, mass practice that's challenging. And I can go through those if you'd like.
Sure, yeah. Give us some examples of that.
Okay. Man, is this simple. And in fact, it has to be kept simple, because if it's not, then you can't teach it to stroke survivors, and only they can drive their own neuroplastic change. You could have, you know, a PhD from the Harvard School of Physical and Occupational Therapy and still not drive it in them. You could know every technique in the universe and not be able to drive it in. They have to do it themselves. It's the only way they can do it. The only way to drive neuroplastic change in yourself is to do it yourself. The only way to have them do it is to do it themselves. So you need to be able to explain these core concepts to them. So the first one is repetitive. You do something over and over again. You know, I mean, if you want to learn, well, that's probably not a good example. If you want to learn any movement, you do it over and over and over again. The problem with that, of course, is it's really boring for stroke survivors. Mm-hmm. They're not learning anything new. They're just relearning or recovering what they already knew how to do perfectly well. So it can get real boring. That's where virtual reality kinds of things come in, other gaming applications. And the way they do it in some therapeutic places is they do essentially circuit training. So in this portion, you might work just on dorsi and plantar flexion. At that station, you might only work on wrist extension and flexion, et cetera, et cetera. So you do repetitive movement. The second thing is task-specific, that you tie it to a specific task, hopefully a task that's meaningful to the patient. The more meaningful it is, the more neuroplastic change will be driven. So it's repetitive, task-specific. The next concept is one that's really kind of foreign to a lot of therapists. It's massed practice. Now, when constraint-induced therapy was developed, it was developed as an eight-hour-a-day protocol for 2 or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Our modification of constraint-induced therapy involves 5 hours a day, 5 days a week, over a period of 10 weeks. In which they're at home, but the therapist only sees them 3 times a week for a half an hour. So it's a much more doable concept, we think. But nobody knows exactly what sort of mass practice there should be. Some people say 3 hours is enough. Some people say you have to have the 8 hours. But all of this is emerging in research, and this is one of the things that makes therapists a little bit nervous. You know, they don't know the exact amount of time. But that's going to vary for every stroke survivor, so it's a little bit about being a detective and figuring out what works. So it's repetitive, task-specific, mass practice, and then the last concept is that it's always made challenging. No matter where they are, if they get to the point where you need where they are, where you want them to be, you have to up the challenge. Otherwise, they're not going to get, you know, just like anybody else, they get better by being challenged.
Mm-hmm. And wouldn't a lot of these four concepts be applicable in many different areas of physical therapy?
Not only physical therapy. I'm writing a paper now about dysphagia, something I knew nothing about.
Sure.
But it turns out that repetitive task-specific swallowing also works.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people who have dysphagia end up not swallowing. Why are they not swallowing? Because they put them in this, you know, they have them not swallow. because they're afraid they're going to aspirate or whatever.
Yeah.
But the only way to reestablish swallowing in somebody whose brain doesn't do it anymore is to have them swallow. So there's some thinking that repetitive practice for that. Constraint-induced therapy and those basic concepts, repetitive task-specific mass practice, also work with aphasia therapy. It also works with a lot of walking protocols. You know, one of the things that physical therapists often do is right out of the box, they'll slap on an AFO and give the person a cane. The AFO freezes the ankle, essentially freezes that joint, and the brain is a use-it-or-lose-it proposition. So if you don't use that joint, those neurons will go get dedicated to something else, or they'll just prune off.
So you would be advocating the limited use of an AFO? Would that be the right way to say it?
Yeah. Well, this is a big question, and one that's hotly debated in research. And certainly not something anybody should do without the consent of their physical therapist and the physiatrist. I want to make that clear right off the bat. Because AFOs actually work, but the problem is they work so well. And so then person gets used to walking like that, and they never develop dorsiflexion and eversion, the two problematic movements. Then the therapist will give them a cane, which forces use onto the unaffected side. You know, so now they're weight-bearing even more on the unaffected side, so you're neuroplastically pruning that stuff back, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's sometimes with stroke, the best thing to do is just challenge the heck out of them. And protocols for the lower extremity for constraint-induced therapy involve nothing more than just challenging the heck out of the affected lower extremity.
Now, the constraint-induced therapy, is that an universally accepted protocol, or is that something that I might find in one hospital and not in another?
Well, one of the things I did for my book was I did a bunch of research to find out who else was doing it, okay? And it's actually few and far between. Steve Page's modified constraint-induced therapy is actually done more often because the 8 hours a day is so hard to get paid for. Insurance companies see that and they go, what the heck are you doing for 8 hours a day? But that's really that or another protocol is the best way to get after rewiring the brain. But there's not a lot of places to do it. You can imagine the logistical nightmare that's involved with getting a therapist and just having them dedicate time towards specific people. The rehabilitation facility has a hard time funding it and justifying it, et cetera, et cetera. One of the things that they're trying desperately to do is to get coding, Medicare, Medicaid kind of coding, for it, so at least they can justify it. Although I will tell you, and I've interviewed therapists who do traditional constraint-induced therapy and get it absolutely paid for, and it has to do with, I guess, lining up your ducks, you know, in rows prior to launching into this therapy. But it can be done.
And figuring out how to do it, yeah. Let's turn a little bit to the book. Why did you write the book, and who is it directed towards?
Well, I wrote the book, honestly, because I couldn't believe nobody else wrote it. And there's all this rich research out there that nobody wrote about. Nobody put it in a unified place. There's a tendency for researchers to, you know, research is this big amorphous ball, and it's kind of clumsy, and researchers tend to retreat into one portion of that ball and focus on that one little question. And we know researchers who spent the last 20 years focusing on that one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was involved in research, and I'm involved daily in research studies. But to me, what's much more interesting is the global perspective about what's going on. So honestly, I just didn't know why nobody else had written it. And I kept thinking that somebody was going to. And that's one of the things that pushed me towards writing it. And I had to get it down on paper and really, like, push. And I bet I could have waited another 5 years and nobody would have written it in any case. But originally it was written for seminars that me and Steve Page do that cover constraint-induced therapy and spasticity reduction and leading-edge stroke recovery concepts, and it was for therapists. And, you know, I happily printed out those and sold them at seminars, and everything was great. And then I sent out a couple of emails to a couple of publishers, and one of them said, yeah, we're interested, but you need to bring it down from the level of therapists into something that can be more globally read. And as I was mentioning to you before, that was something that I spent a few months on. I essentially rewrote the book so that it would be more accessible to more people.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Okay, and Stronger After Stroke is available on any of the online website bookstores, obviously?
You name it.
Okay, and that thus the fun that you have tracking it and watching it climb the charts, so to speak.
It's doing well, thanks.
All right, very good. All right, with us today, Peter Levine. He is a researcher with the University of Cincinnati. Specifically, you're working at the Drake Center in Cincinnati, is that correct?
Right, big rehabilitation hospital there.
Yeah, very well-respected, well-known. If any of you out there, any listeners out there, want to send any information back or ask Peter a question, I'd be happy to forward those on to him if you will let me know by sending me an email at feedback@pttalker.com. Peter, thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely, thank you.
All right, and thank you to everyone out there for listening again. I want to remind you that previous episodes of PT Talker are available at iTunes. And just as we do each and every week, we bring you news and ideas just for therapists. We'll be back again next week. This is May 2009, I believe. It's going to be the 22nd of May, and we hope you'll join us again next week. This is Jeff Worrell saying so long for now.
PT Talker is a presentation of Advantage Medical, bringing you business news and ideas for therapists. Join us each week for new concepts to help you grow your rehabilitation business. To listen to previous episodes, visit us on the web at pttalker.com or on iTunes.